So,
yeah.
I guess I shouldn't make jokes with Blackboard, but it's kind of strange to use it now and then. It gives error messages without any explanation of what's going wrong and stuff like that. When I mentioned Blackboard, you can. I don't know if you've noticed, but there should be a. An app available for it as well, which seems to work pretty well, actually. Both for Android and Apple devices. So search for, if you haven't found it, search for Blackboard Learn, and you should be able to log in there. Today's lecture, we're going to continue a little bit with representativeness biases, the problem with survey studies. And we'll also go a little bit into the area of hypothesis testing and some central terminology there. Finally, we will also have some... I will give some introduction to the project that you're going to do, both for you as on-campus students and an alternative project for those who are off-campus. Maybe some of you will follow the off-campus project as well, so I'll give a presentation of that later here. Start the recording here. So, first, you wrote a small paper last week. I've started reading some of them. That's also an area where I have some struggle with Blackboard to write or to make the evaluation inside Blackboard, so be a bit patient. I've tried with a few, and you will get responses soon. But to the answers, you can maybe say a few words about that for the Kansas paper. What would you say is the independent variable there? Was that easy to find? No? Any suggestions? What's the independent variable in the Kansas paper? It says already in the title. Yeah? Yeah. Whether you're measuring a pancake or Kansas, it's usually called an ex de facto design. You measure something that's existing already. You don't manipulate anything, but it's still two variations of the same thing, or all the stuff you're going to measure. So the obvious independent variable in that study is whether you're measuring Kansas or the pancake. You could probably be creative and say something about pancakes being dependent on Kansas or something. It may be possible, but I think it's difficult. What's the dependent then? Which is also pretty well stated, I think, in that article. Suggestion? Flatness, as measured by the researchers. So their flatness ratio, their formula for calculating that, the result of that formula is the dependent variable. And then you may think a little bit about validity and reliability, of course. It's probably a pretty reliable measurement they have there. If you measure, at least if you measure the same pancake or the same part of the pancake. But of course, different pancakes would probably provide you with somewhat different results, maybe, but probably not very much. You would still get the same conclusions. When it comes to validity, what do you think there? Suggestions? Is it valid? Meaning, yeah? Yeah, so... Yeah, whatever you measure, even if you measure a part of Nepal, probably you would get the same result. So what you say is no, it's probably not valid. But you could say it's internally valid, probably, because within the experiment you would probably get the same result every time you do it. So within the described context it's valid, but the external validity, the conclusions, are weak here, of course. So yeah, good observation. What about the other one then? Independence. First, independent variable. What's the main independent variable, would you say, in that paper? Okay, anyone in the back here? There is one who wants to try in the back there. What is the main independent variable, would you say? Or one of them. Noise, would you say that's the independent? As I see it, the main independent variable in that case is whether you are a computer user or not a computer user. So what we want to look at is the difference between those who those who use a computer and those who don't use a computer, which makes that the main independent variable, as I see it. There are others as well. You could say that the amount of usage and stuff like that is also some independent here. But the dependent variable then is, what would you say that is? Or I can take it. The dependent variable in that case is the actual responses given to a questionnaire. So the actual answers are the dependent. And what we want to investigate was whether these answers was different when there were computer users who answered them compared to non-computer users. We don't need to take the discussion on reliability and validity there, but it's probably a bit more complex than in the first case. Did we ask the right questions? Did we oversee important factors there who made this some or not so good results? If I remember right, what we ended up with last time was a discussion on... by the way, you can, if you felt that you have missed completely on this paper, feel free to resubmit it. So if you have mixed up completely these variables, you can make a new version and deliver that. What we ended up last time was these skewnesses or problems when it comes to representativeness in samples, which may lead us to wrong conclusions or get the results completely wrong. One word we tend to use for situations like this is bias. And bias is then defined as any influence or condition or combinations of conditions that distort the data, that makes the interpretation of the data difficult. And of course, a general strategy is to try to avoid this in any study we do. But it's we could say we could be as strong as say we could probably say that it's more or less unavoidable to have problems with this in some way. The important thing is that we are aware of it, and that we, when we report studies, when we perform research, that we actually are aware of potential sources of biases in the results. Biases may be a result of the measurement instrument we use. It may be a problem based on the selection process, the respondents or participants we have in a study, or it may be due to ourselves, errors that we have done when we ask questions, when we when we perform the study in the methods we have chosen to use. And one of these problems that may occur is what we call can call researcher biases. The fact that we as participants in a study, well, we actually choose a method. We choose the questions to ask. And in that process, we are not unbiased. We tend to choose questions and omit others. And of course, by doing that, we ourselves can create skewnesses or biases in the results that we get. It's also we who choose the way to analyze data, and we who choose what data not to analyze and what subjects not to use, for instance, by different criterias. So we actually are part of this process, making things more difficult to interpret. Why is this happening? Okay. To the part with sampling bias, the problem we get when we don't get the population that we actually were after. Well, there are a few strategies that we may apply to at least allow us to do an analysis and to check whether we have a problem or not. And one such strategy is to make sure that we gather a lot of background, or at least a few potentially confounding variables in a study, or we could call alternative independent variables or confounding variables, like age, educational level, where you live, stuff like that. It's typically demographic data. And if you find skewnesses that you didn't expect based on these things, well, maybe you have a problem with the sampling you have applied in your study, or the population that you actually got. And of course, you can also ask them, if you ask about effects of computer gaming, well, make sure that you also gather stuff like that that has very high relevance when it comes to self-selection. Like, are you actually a gamer, or are you actually extremely interested in these topics? Because if you only get respondents that are extremely focused on this area, that are mainly gamers, if we use that word, well, then we probably have some kind of an issue when it comes to self-selection and a very non-representative sample. So maybe it's still unavoidable, but we need to know about it to be able to interpret the results. When you are dealing with questionnaires, a good strategy is said, and this is well documented in studies, is that the late responses that you get, the last responses that you get, are probably more representative of the population you want to say something about than the first ones. Because first you get those who are very opinionated or very interested in a topic, and they tend to be a very extreme population. But later on, maybe after a couple of rounds with reminders and stuff like that, well, you get responses that are probably more representative of the population you want to say something about. So do a separate analysis of late responses compared to the first ones. That's a good advice. Because data collection in questionnaires may go over weeks, months, for that sake. So you may have an opportunity to do this. A third strategy is to look at or try to get hold of some of the people who didn't respond to your study. Who are they? So try to approach someone who you think should have been part of the study but who didn't respond. People who were invited but didn't take part. So are they different from the population that you actually got? If that's the case, well, you may have a problem. I'm not saying that you absolutely have a problem, but you may have a problem. This is a problem when it comes to interpreting the answers from a questionnaire, for instance. So it goes with other types of data collection as well. But it has to do with our extremely good ability to interpret what a study is about or what the intention behind questions are. So that's human. Humans try to not necessarily consciously, but we tend to try to interpret the background for things and try to understand them in that way. We're not necessarily paranoid, but this is the strategy. We ask ourselves, why is he after this? Why is he asking these questions? And it may also lead then to, well, the outcome of situations like that may be very different. You may have situations where the respondent tries to be kind to you. I don't know why, but he might interpret what you're asking and then give you a socially desirable answer based on that. Or she may oppose you. Or there may be other reasons behind responses if you do this in a let's say in an organization or in a job situation, and ask what type of job they have and how many hours a week they spend at work and how many hours a day they work at home, stuff like that. Or if they have important things to do. Well, maybe there are strategies for the type of answers that you get. Well, we have discussed on the job that no, we don't need more or less office spaces. We actually need better office spaces. So let's say that we spend a lot of time at work and are under the stress there or something like that. So we may have reasons for giving strategic answers as well. So, of course, why do I say this? Well, it's important to spend a lot of time when you do studies where people are asked questions, that you actually spend a lot of time in formulating questions in a good way and choosing good questions to ask. Just one such example from a study that has tells us a little bit about the importance of things like this. Loftus and Palmer, this is a study from way back early 60s, I think. They did a very objective type of simple, quantifiable study where they asked, they showed a couple of films, quite simple movies, to different groups. The film was a pretty simple thing where you saw a car that crashed into another car in front of some kind of a light pole or something, a crossing. So the first car stops, the other one drives into the first car. Not a very dramatic thing, but you would think that this was kind of an ambiguous situation that you created. Well, what they did was that they did a little bit of... They exposed the different groups who saw this film to a little bit of a change in the formulations or the instructions that they gave the test subjects. They used different words. They changed only one word. So what they did was that they said, determine the speed of the last car when it bumped into the first car, or crashed or smashed into the first car. So they changed this one word. That was the only thing they did. And of course, the responses, the dependent variable, was to say something about determine the speed, estimate the speed. So the number they gave there was then the important thing. And when they do this, you can see this. There was kind of a dramatic change based on this one word in the formulation. So when you use the word smash compared to connected, for instance, or contacted, well, there is about 10 miles an hour difference in the speed estimate. Well, this has to do with eyewitness testimonies, but it tells you something about the importance of wordings. And we are extremely good at unconsciously interpret things like this. To make things even more complicated, they asked a lot of questions afterwards, or they let a little time pass, and they asked questions about what they had seen in the situation. What did they remember? How much debris from the first... How much damage was there on the first car? How much debris did they see in the street? Did they see crushed glass, for instance? And... you got pretty much the same results based on the primary question there as well. The more speed they estimated and the the rougher word you used here, the more debris and the more dramatic they remembered this collision. So, interpreting this thing like this, a pretty straightforward thing, a very simple task to the viewers, became actually kind of complicated. This was not very easy. We usually refer to this as what we call demand characteristics, that people actually respond differently based on their interpretation of either the study's intention or the content or questions, etc. Demand characteristics is a term you may encounter now and then. There are, of course, ways around it. The first way around it is, of course, to be aware of it, so that you can discuss it in an active way. But there are also, you could say, hiding the intentions you have in some way may help. It may be difficult, it may raise a lot of ethical questions, but hiding the intention behind a study, behind some kind of a smoke screen, maybe even with false information, is one way of avoiding this. So you actually measure something else than you inform your test subjects about. But as we'll get back to later, this raises a lot of ethical questions when it comes to handling of participants in studies. But it is a strategy that now and then is important to do. If you want to make people reveal password information or personal information, if you want to see whether you can manipulate people by various means to give away sensitive information, well, you can't tell them that this is a study that wants to do this. You have to have a strategy, or you have to hide things. So, yeah, that's one possibility. What do you now and then do in more controlled settings, where you have the opportunity to create two experiments, is to have what we call blind experiments, or even what's called double blind experiments. Blind experiments is experiments where the participants in a study don't know whether they're part of the experimental group or a control group. The typical example here has to do with tests of medications, for instance, in medicine, where one group gets a pill, the other group gets just a placebo, a similarly looking pill or something like that, but that has nothing of the stuff that's supposed to work in it. So that's what's called a blind experiment, and by doing that, well, you can inform the participant in the experiment that he's either in the control group or the experimental group. You don't know which group you're in, and I won't tell you that till afterwards. So by doing that, it's pretty impossible to interpret the intention in the experiment. Well, at least that will affect both the experimental group and the control group in the same way. Double-blind experiments, when I use the word here, is even more sophisticated. It means that you actually also hide it for the people who administer the pills. So neither he or she is aware of which pill he is giving to the person. So that's even putting up another screen to allow for or hiding the intentions in a study, hiding the desired response in a study. Third one is to hide things completely. You just observe something. You don't tell people that they're part of an experiment at all. You just observe things. Just do things. Ethically very challenging. But these are at least strategies you can use. Most easily used in experimental settings. Less easy to use in natural settings and in when you do survey studies, for instance. But at least these are strategies that you may use. Yeah, there are, of course, in your course book, you will find a lot of concrete or good advice on how to formulate questions so you don't get biases in the responses. The type of questions that you ask, that they are actually easy to answer. One very important thing has to do with the actual wording that you use. Don't use ambiguous words, for instance, that words that may mean two things, or questions that may be difficult to answer because it asks. It's possible to interpret them in different ways. A strategy that's often applied in to get good responses and to get more people to respond, not only those very interested, is that you ask very easy questions, maybe funny questions first, and take the serious or maybe challenging questions in the end. Because the idea is then that when people have at least started to get into a questionnaire, have invested some time in answering questions, well, she is likely also to go to the end of the questionnaire or to follow up. So, you will get a number of these good advices in your book. One strategy around this, which may be nice to apply to check that you actually have got good questions, is to check with others. A general strategy we use in a lot of research, at least when you publish research and when you review research, is that you have some kind of a peer review process. You have colleagues, can be friends, to look at your questions first. Do you use proper wording, wordings that the respondents are likely to actually understand? Is it easy to answer the questions? Have you got the right categories of answers that fits the question that's asked? If you ask a yes-no questions, well, it's difficult to rate things on a scale from 1 to 10 as a response, or the other way around. So make sure that these things fit, and have someone look at this for you, because you become blind when you do it yourself. So peer review processes is usually a good thing. Another good thing is to do a little piloting. Instead of running out a full study right away, try it on some friends first, or colleagues or something like that, who is not going to take part in the final study, but make them answer this, time their answers, ask them afterwards if this was easy to understand, were there any difficulties in interpreting this, or was it straightforward? So these are good advices. Okay, that was some short stuff on service. The off-campus students will be invited actually to do a service study. And I guess some of the groups that we will have for the on-campus thing will also gather data from questionnaires. That's an easy way to get data for the analysis that we want to perform here. Something completely different now. Or completely different, maybe not, because it has to do with the types of data or the answer categories that you put into a questionnaire, or that has to do with the type of data you gather when you do observations or perform an experiment. Data can be on different scales, and different types of data gives us different ways to analyze the data. And generally, it's a good idea to go as far up on the list I'm going to present you now as possible, at least for some variables, if you're going to have a good interpretation or a possibility to interpret data. Basically, when I say scales of measurement, it means how many, more or less, how many categories of data do you have? Do you have a numerical scale that goes all the way from minus some unimaginable number to plus a big number with a lot of digits and a lot of precision? Or do you have categories, boys, girls, for instance, which is a good example of the other end of this scale? The last one, and the simplest data, which also gives us some possibilities for statistical analysis, but which maybe is most useful for as independent variables, well, are data that's nominal in nature. Nominal means that it's only names. You can't rank them, you can't put them in any order. It's more or less groups you're dealing with. And the best example is, of course, boys and girls. You can't say that one is better than the other or something like that. That, if you are going to do that, you must do that on some kind of another dependent variable. When you have things like that, you can still describe it. You can do some kind of types of descriptive analysis based on the data. You could say something about percentages observed in each group, for instance. You can say something about the most common value of the names that you have. It can be more than two, of course. It can be a number of things. Colors, for instance, is an example of this. So the name of a color is typically a nominal value. And you can do a little bit of statistics on it as well. Because you can, if you have boys and girls and a category yes and no, for instance, you have a 2x2 table. And you can see whether you have some kind of a deviation, and we'll probably do this later. in the distribution in the cells in this 2x2 table. One step up from the nominal scale is what we call the ordinal scale. And an ordinal scale, well, you have something is more than something else. Not you don't necessarily know that the steps between the different groups you have are similar, but at least you know that a higher value means that it's more of it than the lower value. So higher value is greater, lower value is lower. Educational levels, for instance, is a good example of this. You have only basic education, high school, college, university, more than 3 years at the university, for instance. Well, then you have a rank. And when you have ranks, you can do a lot of... you can do more data analysis. And in some cases, you can even make what's called scales out of ranks. You can sum up different ordinal ranked scales. And by that, actually see it as what's called a scale variable then later. And you can do more, of course, more types of statistical procedures on it. You have procedures like rank orders, where you can calculate whether ranks are deviating from a random distribution. Maybe I can show this later, but. The main idea here is not to tell you about the statistical procedures, it's just to say that if you can gather this type of data, well, you have more possibilities than you had if you only had names to compare. Or on the other end of the scale, then, is what we call interval scales, where you actually can put numbers to things, temperatures. There is some kind of a zero value, so when, for instance, you have a questionnaire where you are asking people to say or to put a mark on a scale from 1 to 10, well, you can consider that as actually an interval scale. So this is a very typical way to ask questions in questionnaires, for instance, which is kind of easy to for the participants to answer. You state something and ask people to highly disagree or highly agree or anything in between to that expression that comes there. And by asking things in a way like that, well, you have a lot of other possibilities. Well, you can calculate means, you can calculate distributions like standard distributions, you can correlate values, you can do inferential statistics, which we will come back to, where you assume that a value is normally distributed and you look at distributions in two groups, for instance. Much more, well, now and then you also see the word ratio used for practical purposes. You could call both interval scales and ratios as, well, you can think of them as scales, and you can pretty much do the same type of calculations on them. Ratio scales is the most extreme of these, where you are absolutely sure that twice as much actually is twice as much, so the value you have established an absolute zero point, for instance, where there are nothing of some of the stuff you want to measure. But consider this as scales. But the important thing is to say that it's probably a good idea to try to have some data that tries to go up this list. And when I want you to do an experiment or gather data in groups later here, I would like you to try to get data in several of these categories or several of these types, so that we can do different types of statistical procedures on them. Okay, time for a break. Okay, let's start again. In case you wonder why I've included these things, it's maybe not very relevant, but it has to do with the how good we are at interpreting connections and how finding patterns in things and finding the context of things is very well built into us. So data is usually not very objective when it comes to this. The example here is, well, I don't know if I have a pointer somewhere here. No, I can probably just do this. So if you look at the thing here, the is thing here, right? Or whatever we call it. This is similar down here. But the way, the context where it's positioned makes us interpret it very differently. So, what does it say here? Fido is drunk, right? It doesn't Fido 15 drunk or something like that. So, but put in this context, the same writing becomes very different. Well, then it becomes numbers instead of letters. So, we're extremely good at this, and the context where thing is put makes the interpretation of the same data very different. Same goes with reading direction. You can look at this drawing here in two ways. You could either look at it from the left to the right or from right to left. Which makes it into a very different drawing. If you read this direction, you will probably see a rabbit and his ears back here. If you read it the other way, you will see a seagull or something. So we're good at this. You can have a number of examples of stuff like this. Where the C can be a nose, a C or the letter, of course. We're also good at recording patterns in the world around us. I don't know if you've seen this before. I think it was one of the first detailed pictures of the surface of Mars made by a sun called, I think it was a Viking sun or something. On this page, when it was published, a lot of people noticed something strange up here. Which were interpreted as maybe actually a sign of life or whatever. Can you see it up there? If you make this a little bit bigger, you see something like this. It looks like a face, right? So the Martians are trying to send a message to us. But this is just an example. We are extremely good at finding patterns when we see stuff. We try to interpret things. It's of course just a lighting phenomena. It has something to do with the way the sun was according to some cliffs or mountains when this picture was taken. If you take it at another point of time, this will be very different from this. But it's created a lot of debate. You have a number of these things all the time. When people are presenting you facts based on singular observations and so-called unfalsifiable and unquestionable data. And it's probably the cause of a lot of this tendency that we have to try to interpret things in known ways is probably one of the main reasons for us having all these conspiracy theories all the time. Which seems to always be based on some kind of facts that's gathered out there. And isolated, it may be right, but the whole picture tend to be wrong. So I know why this is relevant, but it tells us something about our failability when we try to interpret data. We are not very good observers of nature or of data. So maybe somewhat a sidestep, but anyway. Some of you may want to investigate something that has changed over time. And when you try to measure a change over time, you have a few pitfalls, some difficulties that makes this into a somewhat challenging discipline. You can say, yeah, you have two strategies to measure how things are developing. You can either follow people over a long time, the same persons, ideally. That's called a longitudinal approach to investigating change. It has been done now and then. There was a Norwegian psychologist who were one of the pioneers on the measurement of intelligence. Solheim, she started out, well, she's dead now. She died at the age of 90-something, so she was quite old. But when she was 20, she started a study where she followed then young people, measured their intelligence when they were 15, I think, and again when they were 20, and again when they were 25, and then at more sparse intervals, until they were in their 60s. A study that took 50 years to perform. But of course, it gives us a very good indication of how intelligence develops over life. But it's an extremely resource-demanding kind of study, and it's difficult to perform in practical ways. The other strategy you can use is to use what's called a cross-sectional study. And that could be a strategy, of course, to measure the same phenomena. Instead of following these people over 50 years, you could measure 15-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds, and so on, today, and use that to try to interpret how things have changed. Here you may have a few difficulties. And these are fixtures, but not extremely fixtures, data. It's based on an actual phenomena. It is a measurement of the height of male Japanese or Japanese men in different age groups. And where you have used two different methods to measure this, either a longitudinal study or a cross-sectional study. If you do this based on a cross-sectional study, you get some kind of funny results. It seems like 20-year-olds, well, this is some years back, are actually quite high. They have a mean height of over 170, which seems to be pretty stable over the next 15 years or so, or the next 20 years. But then it drops dramatically. So how are we to interpret this? Does male Japanese men shrink at the age of 40? Which would be the most obvious interpretation here. What's happened here, you think? Huh? Once more. No, it had nothing to do with death. So it's not a fallout. Yeah, that's actually a very creative interpretation. Do taller guys die so they fall off the study or something like that? That's a very good interpretation. I don't think that's the case. but it's a good answer, actually. Because you pinpoint the thing here. Something else has happened that makes these results difficult to interpret, and that makes these results come out like this. Because, of course, the true stuff here is the blue line, the longitudinal study. People shrink slowly, but only a few centimeters over the lifespan. That's the true thing here. Now, what's happened here is that sometime after the Second World War, Japanese men got a much more varied the nutritional situation. They got proteins. They began eating proteins as kids. And when you do that, you fulfill your potential for growth much more than if you only eat rice or eat carbohydrates as a kid. So they don't shrink. It's just that during this period, during this time span that we tried to measure, something else took place. And it probably took place, let's say, 40 years ago when we, in these fictional data. Then something happened here. So it we can use this to interpret that something obviously happened at that time. But it doesn't give us valid data on actual the height and the development of height. So it's more like you can use this in another context. But it just highlights the problem of which is sometimes referred to as cohort effects. It might be very important these days when we are studying the things like how we use computers, how we remember passwords, what strategies we use. Because whether you have grown up with computers or not, whether you have grown up with smartphones or not, may affect a lot of the stuff we're going to measure here. So it's not necessarily so that older people are dumber or don't remember passwords as good. It's just that they haven't been exposed to it in the same way as younger people have. So be cautious when you try to interpret change when you measure it in a cross-sectional study. There are strategies around it. You can measure the development in cohorts over time. So follow people over maybe 2 years' time instead of the 20 year you want to say something about and investigate different cohorts. And of course, in this case, if you get strange effects like this, try to interpret why this may have happened. Because this is, of course, obviously strange data, but you may be in situations that's somewhat similar to this. Okay. We probably have mentioned these terms before, but as I'll mention it a lot now when it comes to hypothesis testing. This is only going to be the first brief intro to hypothesis testing, because that's one of the things we'll do when we get data from the projects that you're going to do. A hypothesis is a specified guess or our best prediction of the outcome of a study. And it's necessary to have up front before you actually do any data analysis, and ideally even before you start collecting data, you should be very specific on your predictions of an outcome, because that is what we test when we do statistics. We test the hypothesis. We test the difference between a scientific hypothesis and a null hypothesis. The scientific hypothesis is our expected outcome usually, and the null hypothesis is the statement that no, there is no relationship between variables. And this process that we called hypothesis testing, well, that is a very structured decision-making process where this may be very technical, but what we actually do is to check whether we are dealing with one or several populations. So let's say that we are investigating whether girls are more intelligent than boys. Well, then we get results. We may get a slight difference between boys and girls. It's not so that all girls have the same score and all boys have this score. Well, they are along some kind of a bell curve. They are distributed. Some boys score low, some boys score high. So we are looking at the means of these two groups. And we are, in this decision-making process, we are then determining whether we actually have to do with two different populations or just two, by chance, different scores. We'll show you this later, but then if we are dealing with two populations, well, then there is a difference, and we can reject the null hypothesis. If we are dealing with only one population, well, then you don't reject the null hypothesis. And in this process, we are referring to something called significance levels, because we want there to be an overwhelming chance that the two groups actually are different before we keep our research hypothesis. We're extremely careful here and conservative. So there should be an overwhelming chance that your research hypothesis is true before you reject your null hypothesis. And usually we then deal with different numbers, like 5% or 1% or even 0.1% or something, which is the chance level that we allow ourselves to make wrong conclusions. So if there are, let's say, less than 5% chance that the difference between two groups are there by chance, if there are more than 5%, if the level is higher, well, then we keep the null hypothesis. Or if it's above 1%, well, then we keep the null hypothesis. If it's lower, then we can start believing in our research hypothesis. So it's kind of complicated, but it becomes much easier when you have actual data to work with in this. But one important thing is that you can do two things wrong in this decision-making process. There are two holes you can fall into. You could either do what's often referred to as an alpha error, type 1 error, where you falsely reject the null hypothesis. You say that there is a difference, even though there actually wasn't a difference. That's a type 1 error. Or, of course, you could do it the other way around. You actually had a difference there, but you failed to reject the null hypothesis because in your decision-making process, well, this didn't come out as strong as you wanted, and you kept the null hypothesis, even though behind the scene here or behind this, there was a true difference. That's a type 2 error or a beta error. The important thing to remember here is that we should always, almost always, assume that type 1 errors are the most serious errors. Because that's the situation where you actually say that you had an effect. And that may have consequences for treatment, for things you do later, which is more serious than the type 2 errors. And the chance of making type 1 and 2 errors is then what we, you could say, what we can manipulate with the percentages that I mentioned, the significance levels. If you reject the null hypothesis at a 5% level, well, you are more likely to do a type 1 error than if you put the bar down at 1%. And even more so if you put the bar down at 0.1%. So the higher, or actually the lower number you use for significance levels, the less likely you are to do a type 1 error, which is what we strive to do. Okay, this was just to introduce the concept of hypothesis testing. Next time, or not next week, but the week after, I will probably show you some simple data analysis, but we'll also go through some experimental designs and ways to control data collection. Next week, if you have seen the plan in Blackboard, there will be a presentation from the library here. They will talk about academic honesty, about databases as well, where to search for literature. Some of you may have met them before, but Karen Maria, who's coming here then, she will also introduce your second assignment, or your second short paper this year, which will be a paper on academic honesty. So she will introduce that. So that is next week. So my next presentation will then be the week after. Now, the project. Those of you who are here at campus, you will do a short scientific project where I will help you with the data analysis and try to point out the important things in the process of doing hypothesis testing. But you will have to plan some kind of an experiment that gathers data for us. Preferably data at the different measurement levels, some names, some things all the way up to scale data. When you have done that, when you have performed this experiment, it doesn't have to be a very serious experiment. It can be something fun. I actually encourage you to try that. You should then do this experiment by, I've said by the end of October. Shortly after that, we'll do some analysis together. And based on that analysis and based on your own treatment of this data, because you have access to actually now to the same software packages that I will show you, you will write as a group a short report and make a presentation, which you'll do here in class later this autumn. Now, what project should you do? It's very much up to you, but as I said, something fun is okay. If you're of very serious nature, well, feel free to do something that's relevant for your line of study or something. But it may be just as fun to do something else. And there has been a lot of studies on cultural differences, gender differences, observational studies based on that. But some have also done interesting experiments. I don't know if I mentioned one of the best I had here. 1 year where they built a trebuchet, a throwing mechanism, and threw different hard drives, or similar hard drives actually, with it, but which had different operating systems on them. And they were measuring how heavy different operating systems was. So it was somewhat an inferred thing, but kind of a funny thing. One group a few years ago used some instruments to measure whether the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. So they used some color measurement instruments that we had here. Different designs of paper planes that you can put together is possibilities. But it's up to you to find. I will help you, of course. We can. I will talk to you group wise before you actually plan and perform the study. But you should be assigned to groups, and the assignment to groups here is something I would like you to do yourself. We'll try to use Blackboard for this. We are raising the bar a little here with the usage of Blackboard. If you go into Blackboard on your left side menu, you will find something called My Groups. If you go into that, you will see a number of groups where you actually can choose a group and sign on to that group. Maybe it works, maybe not. I will ask you next week whether it worked or not. But more important is that you talk to some friends and find out who you would like to work with. Ideally, I'd say the group should be 4 people or something like that. Large group is not very good, and fewer than 3 is not good either. So try to find someone to work with. The off-campus students, they will do a different assignment. I will actually, for you that's going to follow the off-campus thing, I will make a separate presentation in Blackboard Collaborate on that. But what you will do then, just to you will find information on it if there are any here who wants to do the off-campus thing, or if anyone is following on Blackboard Collaborate here. You will do a kind of a follow-up study of the one of the papers that you were presented here, the one on internet-connected devices as noise during lectures and meetings. So I will invite you then to actually make a questionnaire, make some new questions, and gather data on that, and that's then data we're going to analyze afterwards. It's hard to find good projects for off-campus students, but do things. If you have the opportunity, do it here in class, do it with your friends, and make it into something fun. Okay, that was the short version. I think we'll finish now. And if you have ideas on projects, if you have had thoughts about this already, you can discuss it with me now. Otherwise, I will invite you group-wise for meetings in a good week's time or something. Okay? And by the way, if you felt that you had missed, just a little bit on the first paper when it came to variables, for instance, in this laptop thing, which may be a little bit difficult to interpret, if you missed just a little bit, if you got the general picture okay, don't resubmit yet. I will probably comment on it, but you will not have to resubmit it. Okay, so but if you have missed completely, feel free to make a new version. Okay, thanks. Huh?